Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? Dobbs. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service out there, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, happy Dobbs Day.
Wow. Amazing. And we're, you know, as you would expect, we were talking about it with the great incomparable Sarah Schutte before we started recording. And the shock of it, you know, in a good way, obviously, cushioned by the leak a month or so ago, still, it's just astonishing. And even after I'd, you know, been standing in front of the TV for a while and looking at Twitter, when I actually sat down to read Alito's opinion, very similar to the leaked opinion, you know, a paragraph in where you just have held Roe was overturned, you know, that one sentence, it's just, it's mind-boggling. And there's just so much incredible thought, legal work, political advocacy, electioneering, activism, prayer that have gone into getting to this place for decades, literally for decades. Friends, colleagues of ours, some still living, some past. It's just a huge, huge moment.
It's a glorious, glorious day. I have like a bookend kind of observation about this, Rich. And one, the end on this side is easy to try to give people the image of, because, you know, the 7 weeks we've just gone through have been so crazy that I think this can be lost. But as uplifted as we are by this today, can you imagine what this would have been if we hadn't gotten the Alito leaked opinion 7 weeks ago? And this had just dropped on us without any warning, not without any insight as to what it would actually say. I mean, I must say, as the House, pessimist at National Review over this, where I was sure, we'd figure out a way to lose somehow, somewhere along the line. If someone had told me, without letting me read it, what Alito's opinion was going to be, and I didn't have any warning about it, I just said, you're crazy. It doesn't happen that way. We don't get a sweeping victory. So that's one thing. And then just to take people back, sometimes it does help to be of a certain age on this podcast, but I remember in 1974 going to in the auditorium at St. Helena's School, where I went to school in the Bronx. I went with my mom to basically a meeting where it was the aftermath of Roe. And we had our congressional representative from our district, from where we live in the Bronx. And it was the first time I ever participated in a political meeting that I can recall. And we all grilled this guy in the nature of, well, what are you going to do about this? And already it was clear, even then, that Roe had been a completely willful act, which is to say it had been a completely political act and not a legal act. And the force of that, you know, it's one thing when Congress carries out a political act, because, you know, the pendulum always swings and eventually you can usually either bite back on that, maybe not completely repeal it, but, you know, erode it, tweak it, fix it. But it became very evident very quickly that because it was the court and because they had done it under the guise of the Constitution, people in Washington were already saying there's nothing we can do about this because the court says the Constitution says this.
Yeah.
And we were like, the Constitution absolutely does not say this. And I was so happy today to see, you know, this is all contemporary from back then. And it seems like a million years ago. It's actually, it's kind of two dimensions of abortion ago, because I always think about abortion in my experience of it as someone who's observed it, you know, the literature and case law about it over the years. I always think about it as two phases. There's, you know, there's Roe to Casey, and then there's Casey to today. So we've been through, like, basically, you know, multiple abortion regimes in all this time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I was really glad, and this again goes back to the 70s, but I was really glad that Justice Alito kept in that bit from John Hart Ely, who was one mm-hmm. of the most prominent liberal law professors of his time, who was honest enough to say, after this excrescence known as Roe came out, that the thing about it is, the signature element about it is, it's not just bad constitutional law. You know, there's a lot of cases where you could say that's bad constitutional law. But what Ely said was, the thing about this is not that it's bad, it's that it's not constitutional law at all. And it doesn't suggest that there's any obligation for it to try to be constitutional law. It was just a completely willful political act.
Yeah.
And it took 50 years to undo.
Well, your memory of that meeting and just the sense, well, you know, what can you do, at least from some people, what can you do? This, the court says it's in the Constitution. That was a tremendous victory that we had to win over and over again, just over defeatism, for people not to give up. And the assumption just always was that we just go away. We drop it, you know, forces of progress, the arc of history, you know, when it was moving in this pro-abortion direction. And we just had to give up and surrender, and we would. And thank God many, many, many millions of people didn't. So let's delve a little into the Alito opinion. One criticism they're making, which is, of course, typically extremely demagogic, is, gosh, Sam Alito wants to take us back to the 19th century and 19th century abortion laws, when really he places such an emphasis on the history, because according to the analysis, if it's not an explicit right set out in the Constitution, yeah, there are other freedoms that kind of attain the status of a constitutional right if they're deeply embedded in the history and practices of the United States. And delving in the history is to show, no, there's never a legal right to abortion that was deeply embedded in American history and practice right up to 1973.
That's right. And actually, where Sam Alito wants to take America back to is not the 19th century, but the 1970s. Where, you know, if you looked at it, at that point in time, the abortion debate was where it belonged, which was at the states. And as the opinion says, what is it? There were 30 states that outlawed it, but the trajectory was moving in, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself said, the trajectory was moving in a reform direction from the progressive standpoint. So, you know, whether you like that trend or you don't like that trend, we obviously have a moral position about it that's different from the legal position. But the point is, it was at least being decided in the place where it was supposed to be decided. And if things were slipping in a corrosive direction, it was because of the culture, not because of the law. And what happened here is, this thing corrupted the law. And all Alito is saying, and all anyone on the constitutionalist conservative side has ever said, is that the Constitution doesn't speak to abortion. And Kavanaugh says this, Rich, I think, flat out in his concurring opinion, which I thought was actually a very interesting opinion. But I like that he, you know, pointed out Justice Scalia's kind of bracing statement, which is, I guess, redundant when we're talking about Justice Scalia. But Scalia said, you know, the Constitution doesn't speak to this. So if a state wants to have abortion on demand, they can have abortion on demand. And if they want to prohibit abortion, they can prohibit abortion, but it's not the court's business. This is something that's in the political realm, and it's really in the state political realm. I mean, the idea of our Constitution in the first place was that the states remain sovereign and were going to govern their internal affairs. And classically, that included things about healthcare, you know, matters about healthcare and safety and the protection of life. So it's not a question of going back to the 19th century. It's a question of going back to the democratic process and taking this out of the place where it never belonged in the first place, wherein it not only hurt our society in many ways, but it's really corrupted the courts, because this is not, it's not like one of these things you can contain, right? It's spread throughout not only the law, but the confirmation system.
Yeah, no, the court thought it was settling the question for the rest of the society, when actually it ended up politicizing itself because the question was so not settled. And so how do you make what do you make of how Alito treated the question of a right to privacy, and how Roe is different from some of the other cases that relied on a right to privacy, you know, Loving and Griswold and those cases, and then what Thomas did with his broadside against substantive due process?
Well, on the I actually think, Rich, I haven't changed my mind. I've actually become firmer in this since we first saw Alito's draft opinion, which I thought was very strong, but I always thought that the weakest element of it, logically, not necessarily rhetorically, but logically, I think the weakest element of the opinion is the court basically, on the one hand, correctly saying, when it comes to unenumerated rights, whether you deem that they come out of substantive due process, which is a very controversial doctrine, this is the Thomas opinion that you're talking about, or the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which is getting a little bit more of a rebirth, especially our friend Randy Barnett has written a book about that in the last year. That's a terrific book, by the way. I read it a couple of weeks ago. But whatever the source, what the court is saying is basically the test that was laid out by Chief Justice Rehnquist in the 1990s, and it was at Glucksberg, where they're saying that if you're going to have unenumerated rights that are given the force of constitutional law out of the 14th Amendment, whatever the source of that is, they have to be derived, they have to be fundamental in the sense of American history and American tradition, and they have to be basic to a system of ordered liberty. And that is only going to, that obviously cuts back on an awful lot of things that you would call rights of some kind of constitutional pedigree. And I've always thought that if that's going to be our test, and I think it should be our test, I think you can have a very robust argument about whether it ought to be substantive due process or the Privileges or Immunities Clause. One of the arguments, by the way, that Randy makes in his book is that, oddly, really ironically, one of the arguments that people who favor doing this by substantive due process, even though, you know, as constitutional conservatives, we hate substantive due process, but that somehow works in the favor of the doctrine, because as Randy points out, because everybody thinks that, you know, substantive due process is just, it's basically nonsense, it becomes very hard to use that, you know, to invoke it. Whereas if you all of a sudden say there is this array of potential unenumerated rights to be given constitutional force through the Privileges or Immunities Clause, that's almost opening the Pandora's box of letting a court recognize that. So there's all this hand-wringing about what test should we apply if we're going to use the Privileges or Immunities Clause, which is probably why it's been moribund for basically over a century. But I always thought the weakness of Alito's position is that if your logic is going to be that it's got to be this core, traditional, elemental to fundamental liberty, then how do the contraceptive cases meet that test? They don't. They simply don't. So now the court is very emphatic in the opinion that this is different. Life is different because we're talking about fetal life. Those cases don't involve fetal life. And I mean, it was a very impressive rhetorical performance, but I would just note that the reason it was necessary to say it is because it's illogical as a position, because it's not really that different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how do you consider how the majority and Kavanaugh dealt with the question of stare decisis? Obviously, you have a lot of people arguing, well, look, we had three justices who basically guaranteed us they'd never overturn Roe because they have respect for stare decisis. And you have this opinion saying, no, actually, you know, stare decisis is not a universal command. You know, once a decision has come down, it must never be reexamined. It's most prone to being reexamined when the court has decided a constitutional matter. And then there are all sorts of other tests that you apply, including, you know, whether it was grievously wrong from the start, which Roe was. And then the reliance interests, they also take that on by saying, look, you know, everyone can prepare for the fact that Roe might be overturned and now has been overturned. It's not as though everyone who is going to be pregnant in America forevermore is pregnant right at this moment, you know, and was planning to get abortion and now can't. So the reliance interest argument is also attenuated and weak.
Yeah, I think, you know, Rich, you actually, I don't know if you remember this, but you pointed out after we sort of dipped into the oral argument here, mm-hmm. that Kavanaugh had been the most impressive on this topic during the oral argument.
Yeah.
Remember, he had this whole riff on all of the different cases, like, you know, Plessy versus Ferguson would still be the law if, you know, if stare decisis was a settled or a dictate. And I think, looking back on it, I think Justice Barrett really brilliantly explained this during her confirmation hearings, where she pointed out that this is stare decisis is not a dictate. It's a test, and it's got multi parts, and it's got to be applied. So when these justices said that they would apply, that they would have respect for stare decisis and respect for precedent, they weren't saying that we will apply precedent in all situations. I don't think the left would want to live in that world anyway. But what they were saying is they would apply the doctrine of stare decisis, which, as you've just pointed out, is a multi-part test, the most important element of which is how badly wrong was the decision in the first place. So before you can even get to reliance and all the other parts of the test, that's a big element of it, which I think is why, again, Ely's observation that this thing can't be defended at all as constitutional law is very important. Here's another thing I think is crucially important on this, Rich. And this doesn't, I don't think this has gotten enough attention, although Kavanaugh gives it some attention in his opinion. I've always, it makes me scratch my head to listen to the left to talk about stare decisis in the context of Roe, as if that would make Roe untouchable. And actually, the only thing that ever really made Roe anything close to untouchable was the political pressure. You know, it's the extortionate atmosphere, the fact that they'd go crazy if something ever happened to it. But if you're going to actually play the game and say, okay, stare decisis. Roe, because of Casey, I believe, is one of the most impossible to defend lines of law on the basis of stare decisis that you can imagine, because it was so unworkable for its first two decades that the only way the court could save it was to gut it, was to completely cut out the innards of it and only maintain mm-hmm. the actual bottom line holding. But otherwise, they got rid of everything about Roe and they replaced it with this impossible to apply undue burden test. Now, that brings us to like the second dimension of this history here, which is Casey. And this is a big problem for the stare decisis people, I think. It always has been. Casey invited more disputes over abortion. It didn't settle abortion. The court purported in that joint opinion between Kennedy, O'Connor, and Souter, the court invited more litigation. Now, in a bottom line sense, they did this nonsense about, you know, when the court calls on everyone to, you know, settle their disputes and let the court settle it. And then everybody's got to respect the opinion, which, you know, Scalia famously made fun of and everybody sensible made fun of, because the court didn't settle it. It made it worse, didn't make it better. But the interesting thing here is, what did Casey do? Casey puts in a test that basically says, we're going to look at, in all these abortion regulation cases, whether the regulation creates such a burden on a woman's right to seek an abortion that effectively the right has become illusory. So we're going to recognize the Roe right. And going forward, we're going to have this test that we apply about undue burden. Well, what did that do? It encouraged every state that was interested in cutting back on the Roe right to see how far it could push regulation. And over time, you know, at the beginning, it looked like the court wasn't going to tolerate a little regulation, then much regulation. And then as time went on, it tolerated more regulation. It was tugging and going back and forth. There was nothing stable about that. It, by definition, it couldn't be stable because Casey was inviting more challenges to Roe. So how could you say that this is such a settled legal environment that even if it's technically not compliant with the Constitution, we've all relied on it and we've all grown our expectations around it, when it continued to be a moving target for decades? Mm-hmm. So I always thought they like to say stare decisis because they think that wins the Roe argument. But if you actually apply stare decisis, this is the most unstable line of jurisprudence that you can imagine.
Yeah, they should all hate Casey for having disturbed the sacred precedent itself and rewritten it on the fly. What do you make of this is more a rhetorical argument rather than a legal one, of course, but, you know, we're hearing it everywhere. We heard it from Biden a little earlier this afternoon. We're recording early Friday afternoon here, that this is the first time ever the Supreme Court has recognized a right and then pulled it away.
What about the property right in slaves?
Yeah.
I actually thought, you know, Rich, I heard the beginning of that thing, Biden's speech. And when he came out and said, you know, he went through his pedigree as like running the Senate mm-hmm. Judiciary Committee and president and vice president and all that stuff. And he said, and I've been a lawyer for all these years. And he says, I believe that Roe versus Wade was right as a matter of constitutional law. And I'm thinking that may be the goofiest thing that Biden's ever said. And, you know, that's like saying something. Nobody who supports Roe thinks it was correctly decided as a matter of constitutional law. It's laughable. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I mean, I don't know how whether Biden thinks he's helping. I suppose they all have to get out there. And, you know, you got to make hay while the sun shines, because they've already lost some time here, in the sense that we've had 7 weeks to educate the country that if Alito's opinion became the ruling of the court, that didn't really mean abortion was being outlawed, that it was simply being turned back to the states. So, you know, they weren't expecting that to go on for 7 weeks. That was the downside for them of the leak. And the upside for us of the leak is that it didn't work, right? You know, mm-hmm. they thought the leak was going to put enough pressure on the court that they'd peel a justice or two off from it. But I think you're going to hear crazy from the Democrats for the next couple of weeks. Not that you don't hear it anyway, but I think it's going into overdrive, because my theory about this, and I've been wrong about enough things that you can take this whatever grain of salt it deserves. But I really think that what was going to happen here, if the Alito opinion became the opinion of the court, was that the next day America was going to wake up and learn that the sky didn't fall, and that things weren't really that different. And all that happened is now democracy gets to work. And it really isn't the catastrophe that the Democrats have painted. And if we're going to do fundraising and try to get political hay out of this, they had to do it like right before the decision came out and then immediately after, because I don't think it gets better for them after that. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a leg up in terms, I guess, of the enthusiasm gap in some places, because now they're going to move forward with aggressively with legislation in various of the states. They're going to try to move forward federally with legislation, but that's not going anywhere. But they'll mobilize in the states. And I heard a lot of people on the conservative side in the commentary today say, you know, this is going to be very problematic because they're going to go into the states and they're going to have, you know, very aggressive pro-abortion laws. And I'm like, you know, this is what it is, right? This is where the battle is from here on out. And yes, they have some enthusiasm and they have some places where they're going to be able to move. But this is the next phase of the battle. It's political. It's not legal. We're good at political. It takes a while to get the ship turned around, right? But over time, we can win this, but we have to be as, you know, the conservative legal movement, you know, we recognize at National Review, the Federalist Society this year, there have been great contributors to the genesis of the conservative legal movement. But, you know, the conservative political movement isn't so bad. It just has to mobilize and it's going to take time. But this was always where we wanted to have the fight. If the fight is in the courts, we're right back to, you know, my meeting at St. Helena's auditorium in 1974, and we can't do anything about it, right? Because the court says so. The court says it's the Constitution, and they're not, you know, we don't get to fire them. They're not politically accountable. So that's that. All we've wanted for 50 years was a fair fight, yeah. Which means we move it to politics. So if, you know, if we have to lose a few rounds, we have to lose a few rounds, but this is where the fight is now.
Yeah. Well, as MBD pointed out, I think it was the night of the Alito leak on Twitter. Look, I mean, it took 50 years just for us to get to the starting gate. And it, just going back to the legal analysis, I mean, Roe is so weak, right? We all knew that, but Alito just demolishes it. I mean, there's nothing.
Yep.
There's nothing to be said for it. And that for 50 years, they managed to keep this thing in place and managed to give it sort of a sacrosanct status in the law where, you know, Amy Klobuchar's made up term, it was a super precedent. It was rather ordinary, right? And a testament to their, you know, their political and cultural power, obviously not their constitutional reasoning.
Yeah. I think Roe was like the Iraqi army and Alito's like Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. I mean, man, he just like, he went through it and there was nothing left. Mm-hmm. But he really did take it on in every particular. I think it is interesting that Thomas decided to pile on with the bit about substantive due process. I think he's making a case of privileges or immunities, clause, which is what he thinks is more faithful to the Constitution. We'll see where that goes. But I don't know that Alito needed that kind of help. I think his opinion really demolished it. Kavanaugh did a very good job on stare decisis. Can I say, Rich, that I really think the weirdest opinion is Roberts?
Yeah, I was just going to get to that. Yeah, why?
So now, as the House naysayer, Roberts' opinion, when you originally asked me about this, and I pretty much stuck to this, at least until we saw Alito's draft, I thought Roberts' opinion was the best we were going to do. Mm-hmm. Half of me thought we were going to lose, and the other half of me thought that Roberts would figure out a way to cobble together a majority for the proposition that, you know, look, we don't need to touch Roe. All we need to do is say the Mississippi law is valid. And we can get rid of, quickening viability, right? We can say viability, that never made any sense, but we don't have to decide what the magic moment is. We'll just like modestly decide this case, very incremental, very Fabian, and, you know, we'll wait for the next case. And the reason I thought that was the best we could hope for, but I do think it's weird from Roberts, because I think Roberts, for the most part, has tried to deflect abortion cases from the court because he knows what a hot button they are. And what he's tried to do, especially in recent years, as the left has gotten more aggressive with the rhetoric about packing the court and all this other political stuff it wants to do to destroy the judiciary as an institution. Roberts has decided, as an institutionalist, that what he needed to do was protect the institution. And what that meant was deflecting whatever really controversial cases that get people amped up politically that he could deflect. And as a result, I don't think they've wanted to take abortion cases. And to the extent that he could indulge his Machiavellian side, I think they've tried to deflect taking those kind of cases. So lo and behold, Barrett gets on the court, and now it's not 5-4 anymore. He's not in the position to control it anymore. He can't be the swing guy on a 5-4 court, which gives him not only, you know, as Chief Justice, he is pride of place. He's first among equals, but also it gives him a lot of cards to play in terms of what cases the court takes. Because if you're a conservative justice, you don't want to vote to take a controversial case unless you think you're going to win. And if you have to worry that Roberts is going to vote with the lefties, then maybe you don't take the case, right? So it gave him a lot of ability to deflect cases. He doesn't have that ability anymore because now the court's 6-3, which is a very different court. So what does he do today? He says, we shouldn't decide this case. You know, we shouldn't decide Roe. We don't need to go there. Let's just decide the Mississippi case, and then we'll see after that how it goes. Well, what does that mean? That necessarily means he's courting more abortion cases for the court. Now, I think he probably only came out this way because it was a loser position. And he gets to say, you know, he gets to look down his nose at the majority and the minority and say, both these extreme positions, I'm not confident enough to go either way. You know, it's just a lot of preening from above. And I wonder if he would have written the same opinion if the breakdown of the court was going to be 5-4 rather than 6-3. But I just think it's ironic that a guy who has tried to keep the court out of controversial cases as a kind of a self-preservation instinct writes an opinion, the effect of which would have been to flood the courts with an ocean of abortion litigation. I find it ironic.
And what do you make of the dissenters? I mean, they have a weak case, obviously, a weak hand. Did they play it well? Anything unexpected, notable in the dissents?
No, I guess, you know, the fact that they it's probably Breyer's last big opinion. And it makes you remember, you know, that memorable opinion he wrote in. So they all three signed the opinion. So that's a little different. I guess it's a testament to the, you know, to the nature of the case. But, you know, Rich, in the end, it's a political argument. You know, it's we're probably because it's such a momentous day, we're not going to get to the we're probably not going to talk much about the Second Amendment today. We'll probably have to leave that for another day. But I do want to say that it's the same kind of thing when you're looking at Breyer's dissent in the Second Amendment case, which is it's political. You know, it's really not a legal argument. It really doesn't address the core legal issues. And here, I think, you know, the joint dissent does the same thing that, you know, the pro-abortion side has been doing for half a century, which is it doesn't even pretend that this can be defended as a matter of constitutional law. And other than to say stare decisis. And I've always thought that, you know, if you're arguing something at stare decisis, it's like, you know, it's you could think of a number of different kinds of contests that where you wouldn't want to be in that position, where basically you're essentially conceding that the decision you're trying to defend is wrong, or at least that there's a large body of opinion that believes it's wrong. And that the only way you can defend it is that it's been around for a long time. And some people have made up their minds about it. And otherwise, you're shrieking. And basically, that dissent shrieks. The Second Amendment case, the opinion shrieked. But, you know, it's not a legal argument. And that's been the problem with this all along. And it's the reason why it belongs in the political realm.
So what, actually, let's discuss a little bit the Second Amendment. First of all, a segue over there to that case. You've heard a lot on cable TV today. Oh my gosh, what's wrong with this court? It's saying that there's this right to, you know, take a gun anywhere, and then ripping away this right key to the status of women in America. So this is a radical court. It's tone deaf, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, Pelosi. That's exactly Pelosi's speech. I think she was the first. Well, Obama tweeted pretty quick, but Pelosi, I think, was the first one to get out there on a podium outside and make a speech. And her idiotic point was that, you know, I'm dizzy here because yesterday the court was talking about, you know, this is a fundamental right. The states can't take it away. And here we are, you know, 24 hours later, and they're saying, you know, the states, this is belongs to the states. They can do what they want with it. And the minor inconvenience that she skips over is that the Second Amendment is in the Constitution, you know, which you would think would be a fairly important detail. But of course, it's not, because this has never been anything but a political argument. And the fact is, you know, on the Second Amendment case, it was really, if you were going to be faithful to the McDonald and Heller cases that they decided in, was it 2008 and 2010, Heller in 2008. This decision is, as the court itself pretty much says, it's inevitable. If you're going to be faithful to it, this is the only correct decision. But I thought they took pains to point out, Rich, that this, they were emphatic about the fact that this does not disturb all kinds of regulation that exists out there with respect to guns now, because once you identify what the fundamental right is, right? So it's a right to keep and bear, which means to, for self-defense purposes, to have in the home and to carry, including concealed carry, weapons that are in common use, subject to whatever exemptions there may be based on American history and tradition. So that leaves a lot of room to regulate. First of all, the other element of it is it's the right of a law-abiding citizen, which itself is a key part of this. So what the court is saying is there's still lots of room to make sure that we're talking about law-abiding citizens, which means that the registration regime is going to be fine. As long as registrations are not a pretext for making the right illusory. In other words, they're not used in a way, they're not ratcheted up in a way that makes the right disappear under the guise of regulation. But if the point of regulation is to make sure that somebody's a law-abiding person, you can regulate. There are traditional categories of people who the government can disqualify. Felons and the mentally ill, most prominently. Also, people with substance abuse problems. Those categories, I think, are all going to be upheld. Sensitive location. Now, this was actually kind of amusing because what Justice Thomas points out, Justice Thomas having written the Second Amendment case, Bruin, what Thomas points out is that, you know, traditionally, you were always able to prohibit guns to be brought into certain sensitive locations, like government buildings or courthouses, for example, where there'd be lots of mingling of the general public and the buildings were heavily secured so that, you know, law enforcement was pervasively protecting the location. And under those circumstances, you could prohibit people from carrying guns in. Now, what Thomas says is what New York has tried to do here is pretend that Manhattan is a sensitive location because there's lots of people milling around and the NYPD is there. So what what Thomas says is, you know, no, that's not really a good analogy. We're not gonna. Basically, he says, nice try, but you know, no. But you know, if you can analogize it to what the old American tradition is of, if you have sensitive locations, you can prevent people from bringing firearms in. Those regulations are probably going to be upheld. So the court has left a lot of rhythm for regulation here, but it has upheld what the core right is. And I don't think anybody should be surprised by this, because it's a faithful rendition of what the Second Amendment is. And I know, you know, the left doesn't like Heller because they don't like Heller, you know, so since the amendment has the word militia in it, they say it's only a militia, you know, and Justice Scalia bulldozed that argument, you know, 15 years ago, whatever it was. And this is the natural outgrowth of it. And a lot of it, you know, I think the left often has, well, you could say the same thing on our side too, I suppose, but they have themselves to blame, because it's not enough for them to make sensible regulations. They have to go draconian. And, you know, it turns out when it gets to a court that's actually going to faithfully apply the Constitution as it's written, it can't be defended. And that's what happened there.
So we still have a couple more decisions that'll come down next week, but just in general, especially with regard to Dobbs and this gun case. So is the Roberts Court now, in your view, kind of firing on all cylinders and the closest we've gotten to what we would consider an ideal constitutionalist conservative court, or is it still significantly short of that?
Rich, I've never seen a court like this in my lifetime. I mean, and the court was, you know, I would say since FDR and the court packing episode, you had a progressive court of one orientation or another. And there were times when conservatives either tried to push back on that, or, you know, thought they were pushing back on some of the radicalism, but, you know, they didn't pay enough attention to things like judicial appointments. So like Eisenhower, nominally a Republican president, puts, you know, William Brennan and Earl Warren mm-hmm. on the court, who turned out to be, turned the court in a radical direction. It was Nixon who put Harry Blackmun on the court, and Warren Burger, who were both in the majority. Blackmun, of course, wrote it in Roe. And, you know, Reagan, I think, especially with, you know, a great nod to Ed Meese here, Reagan had a theory about moving the court in a more constitutional conservative direction in the early days of originalism as a legal intellectual movement. But I think it was very mixed success in terms of who we got on the court.
Yeah.
It was probably the greatest coup. I know we have the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union and the Iraq War. Probably the greatest coup of George H.W. Bush's presidency is to get Clarence Thomas on the court. Mm-hmm. And I think we did hit our stride in this century. And now we have an actual working conservative majority that's reliable. You know, it doesn't mean we're going to be happy every single time. We're not happy every single time. We've talked about a number of cases that we were disappointed about. But I think a lot of the disappointment has been on the emergency docket, where you have some of the conservative justices like Barrett and Kavanaugh have misgivings about dealing with cases on the emergency docket rather than regularly argued in the court's normal process. But I think if you get those cases that are regularly argued in the court's normal process, you have a working 6-3 conservative majority. And I think people need to understand, this is the last point I would want to make about this, because to me, it's the most important point. When we say conservative justices, we're not saying, well, there's conservative justices and there's liberal justices, and conservative justices push for conservative outcomes and liberal justices push for progressive outcomes. That's not how it is. Liberal justices do push for progressive outcomes. They're progressive oriented. Constitutional conservative justices are about more about process than outcome. They are more about what is the proper role of the court in a democratic republic of limited powers that is confined by the Constitution. So what the constitutional conservative, when we talk about conservative justices, we're talking about what issues should the court be deciding and what limits are on the court when they do get to decide them. So for example, if we're going to talk about abortion, when the left had its abortion regime, it was Roe, and it was basically abortion on demand as a policy outcome. Whereas when constitutional conservatives have finally had their day 50 years later and won, it doesn't mean that we've now made up a right to life in the Constitution, right, that basically from the moment of conception protects life. I wish that we could say that there were such a thing in the Constitution, but there's not. So the order that the court has imposed, and by order, I mean orderliness, is that the Constitution doesn't speak to abortion. And as Scalia said, you can have abortion on demand if you're a state, as far as the Constitution is concerned, or you can completely prohibit abortion. But it's not the court's business. It's democracy's business. And it's a much better day.
So that's a great place to leave it. And that's all the time we have this amazing week. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich. Great day.